Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is the 28th of September, and we're going to finish up nervous system. And I don't want to say if we're going to have a test on Thursday or not just yet. I want to talk a little bit, and let's just see if we can finish this particular chapter up and answer questions. All right, and do other things to the AV system. Test, there we go. That's pretty good. That should be loud enough. Maybe this is louder. All right, so you guys come to order, or I'll turn the microphone back up. All right, so we're going to finish up nervous system. And then eventually we're going to move on to this figure right here and talk about this figure because it will help your understanding of everything. Oh, I don't want that over there. Maybe I can put that over there. Escape. Sorry about that. So if that's the case, then I want this diagram. I want this diagram. Over here. And then I'll put the PowerPoint over here. Okay, that's going to work. Then I'll put this down over there, and we got everything we need. Fantastic. Okay, so last time we were talking about synapses and how an action potential reaching an axon terminus is going to cause the release of neurotransmitter from that axon terminus. And there is an ion that enters the terminal button or the axon terminus, right, because there is a special voltage-gated channel. It's not your usual kind of ion. It's not a sodium voltage-gated channel, but it's a calcium voltage-gated channel. When an action potential comes down and calcium rushes in the cell, of course you should know that because calcium is high outside the cell, and then via this regulatory mechanisms, the vesicles that are already docked at the presynaptic membrane exocytose neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And that's controlled by calmodulin and a number of enzymes, right, that can either phosphorylate or dephosphorylate regulatory enzymes. So if it's an enzyme that phosphorylates something, it's a kinase. If it dephosphorylates something, then that would be a phosphatase. And you should always know that if you're going to have a very precise control mechanism where you have precise control and balance, what kind of control mechanism should you have? Like an antagonistic control mechanism, right? Like gas pedal, brake pedal, muscles for flexion that work with muscles for extension, right? So if you just have a kinase enzyme, that's not very good control. You also need to have a phosphatase, right? So then you have precise control over that particular metabolic pathway. All right, so this is important because we see the important role that calcium plays in synaptic transmission. All right, so that's the other thing I wanted you to see on that particular slide. Okay. All right, and I think we kind of ended here last time, and that is that when you have a ligand-gated channel, and that ligand-gated channel, let's move over to the picture of the neuron. Where do we have ligand-gated channels on this scheme over here on the right-hand side? Okay, the cell body and dendrites have ligand-gated channels. And when a ligand binds to those channels, it's going to either cause a depolarization, which is excitatory, or a hyperpolarization, which is going to be inhibitory on this neuron over here. All right, so as a matter of fact, if depolarizing channels open up, that's going to produce an excitatory postsynaptic potential. That's excitatory. But if a ligand binds to a different kind of receptor protein on a dendrite or cell body, that opens up a channel that hyperpolarizes the membrane, then that takes the RMP further away from threshold, and that inhibits the neuron, right? And so these depolarizing or hyperpolarizing events affect voltage-gated channels in the postsynaptic cell. And where is the first place that you run into a voltage-gated channel on the slide over here on the right? Right here in this trigger zone, right? So dendrites and cell bodies don't have voltage-gated channels, and only the axon does, starting right here at the trigger zone. So another way of thinking about this neuron is that we have EPSPs, or IPSPs, on dendrites and cell bodies produced by ligand-gated channels. When those ligand-gated channels become activated, it produces graded potentials. Graded potentials means that they will flow over dendrites and cell bodies, but they will lose their intensity. They will propagate with decrement. They'll fade away. But if those graded potentials reach the trigger zone right here and they're still above threshold, then an action potential will start, and then an action potential moves down the axon all the way to the axon terminus without decrement, right? The amplitude of that action potential is going to be exactly the same at the trigger zone compared to the axon terminus over here. But you have to have a special membrane protein in order to do that, actually a couple of them. What kind of proteins in the membrane do you need for an action potential that you don't always have over here at dendrites in the cell body? And those are the voltage-gated channels. So axon has voltage-gated channels that produce an action potential. Dendrites and cell bodies have ligand-gated channels that produce graded potentials. All right, the other thing we learned about action potentials is that they do not summate. And the reason is because of the absolute refractory period and relative refractory period of an action potential. So you should familiarize yourself with that concept and where they exist on an action potential. All right, so dendrites and cell bodies are the receiving end of the neuron, and that's because it has ligand-gated channels. The axon is what we call the sending end of a neuron because it has voltage-gated channels. All right, so these are all different ways of thinking about the function of a neuron, all right, in terms of its proteins that are in the membrane or the kinds of electrical events that these membranes can propagate. Okay, so let's take a look at the next slide over here. So graded potentials are produced by ligand-gated channels. And graded potentials could have one of two different characteristics. They can either be EPSPs or IPSPs. Right, these are all graded potentials. And what kind of membrane protein produces a graded potential? A ligand-gated channel. And where do you find those? Dendrite, neuron cell body. That's why we call that the receiving end of a neuron. And remember, graded potentials are variable in amplitude. They propagate with decrement. And since there's no refractory period, they can also summate. But they can also cancel each other out, right? So an EPSP can cancel out an IPSP or vice versa. All right, so good question here is, what part of a neuron is the receiving part and why? So here we have a nice neuron. What's the receiving part? Dendrite, cell body. And more importantly, why? Because it's receiving signals, it's got a receptor, and that receptor is what we call a ligand-gated channel, right? What part of the neuron is the sending part and why? Axon, because there are different kinds of channels, voltage-gated channels, not ligand-gated channels, right? Okay, so remember, graded potentials can summate. So if the membrane potential reaches threshold at the axon hillock right here, then this axon will transmit an action potential. So every neuron in your body, right, can make a decision whether or not to send an axon, to send an action potential down the axon. Right, that is really interesting. So this is really the integration center. It kind of looks like a funnel. Right, so maybe you should use that picture in your mind. All the graded potentials are funneling in to the axon hillock, and then the axon hillock decides whether or not to send an action potential down to the axon terminus right here. And what's the criteria for the decision as to send an action potential or not? Has it met threshold or not? Has the membrane potential met threshold? So not only can you make decisions, but every neuron in your body can make a decision as to whether or not it's going to pass that excitation on or not. I don't know if this might be an exam figure. I'm not really too sure. But we're talking about transmission of information from one cell to another that are neighboring cells. We call that synaptic transmission, right? And can you remember how many different kinds of synapses there are? Two general kinds, right? What are the two general kinds? Chemical and electrical. Electrical need what kind of membrane protein? You need a gap junction, right? You need connections. But what we're talking about is a chemical synapse where a neurotransmitter has to diffuse through the synaptic cleft or across the synaptic cleft from the presynaptic neuron to the postsynaptic neuron, right? So when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, that change in voltage opens a calcium channel, right? That calcium that floods the cell working through calmodulin causes release of neurotransmitter. The synaptic vesicles fuse to the presynaptic membrane and they diffuse across the synaptic cleft. So this little space right here between these two blue boxes would kind of illustrate the synaptic cleft. And electricity can't just hop across that synaptic cleft because then it would be like a lightning bolt. We don't have lightning bolts inside our body, right? It's transmitted via that chemical that moves down a concentration gradient. That chemical or neurotransmitter then binds to a ligand-gated channel on a dendrite or cell body, which opens, for instance, a sodium channel. And when sodium channel opens up, what happens to sodium? It rushes inside the cell. What do we call that? That's a typical depolarizing event, right? So that's going to depolarize, bring the cell closer to threshold, so we call that an EPSP. And that signal kind of dies away as it travels from that site of excitation. All right, so there's a localized decremental conduction of EPSPs. It's finally going to reach the axon hillock. And if it's at threshold, right, that's going to open voltage-gated channels and an action potential will ensue. And then potassium channels will open. What good are these potassium channels that open up? What do they cause? The second part of an action potential, which is what? Repolarization. Yeah, and even a little bit of hyperpolarization, which produces that relative refractory period. And then since the axon is loaded with voltage-gated channels, both the sodium and potassium, conduction of that action potential moves all the way down the axon on the slide on the right. And we call that a nerve impulse, an action potential in motion. Okay, so let's talk about some neurotransmitters. These are ligands that the presynaptic cell is going to release. The most widely used is acetylcholine, always abbreviated ACH, capital A, capital C, lowercase h. It's used in the brain and in the autonomic nervous system, and it's used at all neuromuscular junctions, right? So every time you have a motor neuron going to skeletal muscle, acetylcholine is released by the motor neuron at the motor end plate on the muscle fiber itself, all right? And one neurotransmitter, namely acetylcholine, can have a number of different effects on the body. Sometimes it's excitatory, sometimes it is inhibitory. So the same neurotransmitter can have even opposite effects in the body, and you should know why that is. Even though the neurotransmitter is the same, if it has a different action on a cell, it's because there are different kinds of receptors that it will bind to, and the cell determines what kind of receptors that it places in the membrane. So for acetylcholine, there are two major subtypes of receptors. They are called nicotinic and muscarinic receptors. They will have different effects on a cell. Okay, one class we call nicotinic because nicotine will bind to these receptors and cause stimulation. And there are other classes of receptors where nicotine doesn't bind, but another compound called muscarin, which comes from a mushroom, a poisonous mushroom, will bind to these receptors right here. All right, so that shows that there is a little lack of specificity in some of these receptors. They all bind acetylcholine. Some will bind nicotine. Others will bind muscarine, even though they all bind acetylcholine. All right, and some of these can be excitatory or inhibitory, not because the neurotransmitter is different, but because what? The receptors are different. All right, so let's take a look. All right, so ligand-gated channels contain both a receptor site for a neurotransmitter and an ion channel. It's got to have both of those components. All right, and the ion channel opens up when a ligand binds to the receptor. So I think here we have a really nice figure, and there's animations in Blackboard that you can look at. All right, here is a typical nicotinic kind of ligand-gated channel. Ligand-gated because it's going to bind acetylcholine on these receptor sites right here on the channel. And when this particular protein binds to acetylcholines, it's going to change conformation. Right, it's going to go from a closed to open conformation like this. And this is primarily a sodium channel, but some potassium can leak through too. So when it opens up, remember, sodium will move down its concentration gradient into the cell. It's also favorable because the electrical gradient will also help draw sodium inside the cell. So what happens to the electrical properties inside the cell in the cytoplasm when sodium rushes in? That's a typical depolarizing event, right? And so that is excitatory. So we don't really have to pay attention much to potassium that leaves through this channel, okay? But maybe you should just be aware that it happens. All right, so what kind of postsynaptic potential is produced when sodium enters? Is it an EPSP or an IPSP? EPSP, because it moves the membrane potential toward threshold, and it might even reach threshold by the time that graded potential reaches the axon helix. So this is a typical nicotinic receptor, and in this particular case, you said it is what, excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. And as a matter of fact, you could probably memorize that. All nicotinic ligand-gated channels are excitatory. So that's kind of nice. That kind of simplifies the nicotinic channels. Okay. Other kinds of channels that have acetylcholine binding sites, all right, are this family of G-protein coupled channels, right, where a neurotransmitter receptor is not part of the ion channel, right, that there's just a separate receptor in the membrane, and that receptor has those three subunits, the alpha, beta, and gamma subunit, that become activated, and they dissociate from the receptor, and they can diffuse through different places of the membrane, and those subunits can bump into an ion channel and change the state of an ion channel in the membrane. All right, so here is probably a really nice exam figure, okay, where the binding of one acetylcholine molecule to the receptor activates this G protein right here, causes dissociation, and for instance, the beta and gamma subunit then can diffuse around inside the membrane right here, because remember, the membrane is very fluid, and when the beta and gamma subunit bump into this channel protein, it causes the opening of this channel protein, and if it's a potassium channel, that's going to allow potassium to move out of the cell. And what does that do for the cell? Well, how does that change the physiology of the cell, or the electrophysiology of it? What happens to membrane potential? It hyperpolarizes. So is that producing an IPSP or an EPSP? That's an IPSP. It takes membrane potential farther away from threshold, therefore it inhibits this particular cell. Okay. In other cells, this particular channel might be a sodium channel that opens up. If it's a sodium channel, then we have sodium entering the cell, and what is that going to produce? An EPSP, right? So even though one signaling molecule, namely acetylcholine, is binding to this receptor, it can either cause hyperpolarization if it's a potassium channel, or it could cause depolarization if it is what kind of channel? A sodium channel. All right, so that's pretty handy information. Now, so this is a G protein coupled receptor. It is not a channel, but it shares information with other channel proteins within the cell. Okay, so this is a typical muscarinic. It can be excitatory or inhibitory. The receptor is different from the channel, as opposed to the nicotinic receptor, which is what? A receptor channel protein all combined together. All right. The receptor channel, in this particular case, the nicotinic, has to bind two acetylcholines, while the G protein coupled just one acetylcholine molecule. All right. So both of these are what we call cholinergic systems because they rely on acetylcholine to change the state of these protein channels right here. All right. Well, when acetylcholine is submitted into or released into the synapse, I think you should have an idea that its effect should not last a really long time. All right. So, for instance, think of I might have to mute the microphone. Maybe I'll just put my finger over the... There, I went away, but I can come back. It might start to howl. All right. So if you have a neurotransmitter that's being released to signal a postsynaptic neuron, you don't want that stimulation to exist for a long period of time. You would like for it to go away. For instance, if I'm going to signal you right now with these lights, oh yeah, here's a good light. Okay, I can signal you right now. I could go and then okay, what did I just transmit to you? It was SOS. Okay? So in order to transmit information to you, I had to turn the light on and off. On and off, and of course with the right kind of repetition, so those of you that know Morse code, right, could get that, receive that information. Well, neurons have to do that too. They have to be able to turn the signal on or off. What good would that light switch be if I turned it on once and I could never turn the light off again? What would happen to transmission of information then? Well, it would stop, right? So the synapse, right, you should be able to turn these receptors on and off at the same time. And the way that the system works is that it gets rid of the neurotransmitter. So once a neurotransmitter is secreted into the synaptic cleft, right, it gets degraded. It can't live in the synaptic cleft forever because that would be like leaving the light switch on forever. So there are enzymes that break down acetylcholine, and guess what we have right here? Acetylcholine esterase, you know that's an enzyme. And what membrane is that found in? Well, what two membranes do we see? We see the presynaptic and the postsynaptic, and acetylcholine esterase is in the postsynaptic membrane that breaks acetylcholine down into acetate and choline. And are you kind of familiar with acetate? What is acetate? How many carbons in acetate? Two. Yeah, and that can enter the Krebs cycle, for instance, or as these compounds get taken back up by the presynaptic cell, they can be resynthesized to make acetylcholine. But anyway, when acetylcholine esterase breaks acetylcholine down into acetate and choline, these molecules right here, namely acetate and choline, don't have the right shape to bind to the receptor, and that terminates the action of synaptic transmission across the synapse right here. All right, so that's got to be there. There's got to be ways to deal with the neurotransmitters to decrease their activity. All right, so acetylcholine in the peripheral nervous system, all these neurons we call cholinergic because they use acetylcholine. There are large synapses in the junction between nerves and muscles, like a motor neuron and a muscle. We call that the neuromuscular junction. And there are so many receptors in the neuromuscular junction and some other features of that junction. We call that a end plate or a motor end plate. And when acetylcholine binds to receptors on a muscle, it produces PSPs, or end plate potentials, and these are always huge. So when a motor neuron stimulates a muscle fiber, it always reaches threshold, right? And so a muscle fiber, a skeletal muscle fiber, can never make a decision whether to contract or not. Unlike this neuron that we see over here on the right-hand side, because of the proteins in the trigger zone, right, a neuron can decide whether it's going to create an action potential or not. But a muscle fiber, a skeletal muscle fiber, let me go back over to the left-hand side, will always cause contraction, okay, because that motor end plate potential is so big. So there are voltage-gated channels right there within the synapse, which is not true with the neuron. All right, so here we have synapses on dendrites and cell bodies. Do we have any voltage-gated channels here at a neuron? No, we don't get to them until what? Till the axon hillock. But on a muscle cell, skeletal muscle cell, there are voltage-gated channels right within the synapse, and that will always cause an action potential in the skeletal muscle cell. All right, and there's a chemical compound that blocks the action of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction that will prevent muscles from contracting, and that is curare. It's produced by a plant, and some insects will eat that plant, accumulate this particular compound, and then something's going to eat those insects. There is a little frog, like in South America, that likes to eat those insects. So the frogs then accumulate curare, and actually they excrete it through some slime on their skin, some mucus on their skin, and somebody figured out, you know, eons ago that if you were to harvest that mucus and coat your little arrows with this compound, curare, you could use it as a very nice aid in hunting. So you didn't need to have really big, huge arrows to take down big game if you had your arrows coated with this particular compound. All right, so that's what the indigenous peoples in South America learned to do. Okay, but of course, with those arrows or little darts, what did you have to do? Be with them? Really careful, right? Like never jab yourself in the finger or eyeball or anything, right? Okay. So people way back when knew a lot about receptor technology, but of course they didn't really appreciate the interaction, right, of receptors and agonists at various different kinds of receptors. All right. Here's another kind, here are another class of neurotransmitters. This includes serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. In order to make serotonin in your body, you need to have tryptophan. And tryptophan is an amino acid. And maybe you know that all the amino acids can be broken down into two general groups. There's various ways we can classify amino acids, but one nice way is that there are some that your body can make on its own, and then there are other amino acids that your body can't make, but you need, but where do you have to have them then? If you can't synthesize them, you need to have them in your diet. We call those essential amino acids as opposed to the ones that you can make. Those are non-essential. All right, tryptophan is an essential amino acid. All right, and so in order for your body to make serotonin, guess what you have to have? The proper diet. Okay, and for instance, what is the kind of protein that has tryptophan? It is an animal protein. Not all plants produce tryptophan. All right, so depending on your diet, that will affect various neurotransmitter levels. So I think you should find that really interesting. I do. Okay. Norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from tyrosine. And just like tryptophan, tyrosine is an essential amino acid. So synaptic transmission, again, can be affected by diet, right? If you don't have the proper diet, then you might be deficient in some of these neurotransmitters. All of these neurotransmitters we call catecholamines. And now we'll probably maybe talk a little bit about what some of the effects of these various transmitters are, which might be affected by diet, for instance. All right, what are these? Monoamine neurotransmitters? Let's talk about attenuation of their effects at the synapse. All right, so it's the same kind of scheme. When an action potential comes down, calcium goes inside the cell, it causes the release of neurotransmitter, and the neurotransmitter, this is not going to be a nicotinic or muscarinic receptor because we're talking about norepinephrine, epinephrine, serotonin. These are all G protein coupled receptors. So these are not ligand gated channels. Right? These are G protein coupled receptors. And again, sometimes this G protein coupled receptor can produce inhibitory or excitatory events on the postsynaptic membrane depending on how it's coupled, right? What kind of ion channels are used. So norepinephrine will diffuse across the synaptic cleft, bind to this receptor, but what do we have to do about the action of norepinephrine? We have to terminate its effect so that it doesn't last forever, right? We don't want to flip the switch and then have to live with that switch with the lights turned on, right, for the rest of your life. All right, so you got to turn that light off somehow. This norepinephrine in the synaptic cleft is not broken down by enzymes on the postsynaptic membrane, but norepinephrine is taken back up by the cell that secreted it, which is the presynaptic neuron. We call that reuptake. So most of the norepinephrine and other compounds like serotonin is taken back up, and if it's inside the cell, then of course it can't bind to the receptors on the postsynaptic membrane. And once inside the cell, it is degraded by monoamine oxidase, MAO. And then it can be resynthesized to make norepinephrine. So this is the pathway for terminating the action of norepinephrine. And maybe you've heard of monoamine oxidase inhibitors, because one of the theories of depression, clinical depression, is that there's an inactivity of norepinephrine pathways in the brain. And so to enhance these pathways, right, then you can block the reuptake, or you can block the degradation by MAO that increases the time norepinephrine is spent in the synapse and the time that it is bound to the receptor. That enhances the effect of these various pathways, and that's a very nice way of treating clinical depression, okay, by reuptake inhibitors and MAO inhibitors. So let's take a little look at how these receptor systems work. We said it was a G-protein coupled receptor. So here's the receptor, here's the G-protein. So norepinephrine is a signaling molecule that binds to the receptor that activates the G-protein. It's going to cause dissociation, right, of these subunits. This alpha subunit is going to wander around inside the membrane, and it's going to bump into another protein. This protein right here is not a channel. It's actually an enzyme. What does an enzyme do? It speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction, right? And this particular enzyme is called adenylate cyclase. And the job of adenylate cyclase is to take an ATP and notice, where is this activity working? Is it outside the cell or inside the cell? It is now inside the cell, so it converts ATP into AMP, but a special kind of form that forms a cyclic compound, so cyclic AMP. So now levels of cyclic AMP build up inside the cell, not outside, all right, because adenylate cyclase is activated. So you got to know the name of this enzyme, adenylate cyclase, and what the reaction is that it catalyzes. Okay. So what do we call the, what is the relationship between this molecule here, norepinephrine, and cyclic AMP? We've kind of talked about that already. In terms of the scheme of taking a signal that's outside the cell, trapped outside the cell, what, how does it change something inside the cell? That process is what we call signal transduction, transducing it across the membrane using the G-protein coupled receptor and adenylate cyclase. So what do we call norepinephrine in the most general form of signal transduction? That is the first messenger. Somebody said that, first messenger. Where do you always find the first messenger? Outside the cell. But nonetheless, through this mechanism right here, it produces what? A second messenger inside the cell, which is cyclic AMP. Okay, so norepinephrine doesn't have to enter the cell. Cyclic AMP is going to convert a protein kinase from an inactive form into an active form. And what does a kinase do? It runs around phosphorylating everybody that can be phosphorylated, right? So it's phosphorylating various proteins. It's a big, bulky, reactive group, so it's going to change the conformation of various proteins inside the cell, and including other proteins that are in the membrane. Like when this ion channel becomes phosphorylated due to the activity of this protein kinase, right, it might open this ion channel. And if it's a sodium channel, it's going to cause depolarization. If it's a potassium channel, it's going to cause hyperpolarization. Or, for instance, let's give you another example. Maybe it's a chloride channel. What's going to happen then? Where's chloride high? The chloride ion, Cl minus. Where's that high? Outside the cell. When it opens up, what happens? It's at high concentration outside the cell. It's going to enter. And what's the state of the membrane potential when it enters? Depolarize or hyperpolarize? Hyperpolarize, so that will that excite or inhibit the cell? It will inhibit the cell as well. All right, so one neurotransmitter can have opposite effects depending on what ion channels are being activated. Okay, so there's something that's interesting that's happening right here. This is what we call a cascade mechanism, where we can turn on a number of enzymatic steps inside the cell. And let's just see what happens to the signal. So how many molecules of norepinephrine did we need to turn on this ion channel right here?
One.
We just need one. Okay, so norepinephrine binds to the receptor. That activates adenylate cyclase. Now, does adenylate cyclase get changed by the reaction it catalyzes? When it makes a cyclic AMP, does it get changed?
No.
What can you tell me about enzymes? No. They don't lose their activity. So this adenylate cyclase, does it make one cyclic AMP or hundreds or thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands? All right, maybe even hundreds of thousands of cyclic AMPs build up inside the cell. So what do we call that step when you go from one molecule to thousands and thousands of molecules? That is like what? That's what we tried before, right? That is what? Amplification. You're amplifying that signal, right? So that is a level of amplification when you go from one molecule, one first messenger, to thousands of second messengers inside the cell. And that's really nice because now you can activate, what, not just one protein kinase, but thousands of protein kinases. All right, and after protein kinase phosphorylates this channel right here, does the activity go away? Because it's an enzyme. Is an enzyme altered by its activity? So this one enzyme here can activate thousands of ion channels. All right, but how many protein kinases have been activated? Thousands, because there were thousands of cyclic AMPs. So that's another level of what? Should I do it? Another level of amplification. Right? So these G protein coupled receptors can make things happen inside the cell very rapidly, right? And with a high degree of amplitude change, because this signal transduction scheme uses a cascade mechanism, and it employs the properties of an enzyme. Namely, an enzyme doesn't get turned off after it catalyzes its reaction. So you should know a cascade mechanism causes this signal transduction, first messenger, second messenger, but it also produces a number of levels of amplification so that things can happen very fast. So it's a really nice control system. Okay, that's for neuroimmune transmitters. A good example, for instance, would be serotonin right here. Serotonin is involved in regulation of mood, behavior, appetite, cerebral circulation. I know some people suffer from migraine headaches, which has to do with cerebral circulation, which probably is related to serotonin, and probably some pharmaceutical therapies that adjust serotonin levels to help people control migraine headaches. All right, LSD. You guys probably don't know anything about LSD anymore, but it was a psychotropic drug that was used in the 60s, right, to take trips without leaving the house. And it has the same specificity as serotonin, so it can bind to what? Serotonin receptors in the brain and apply various silly signals in the brain that are very difficult to interpret. Okay, and then there are serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors, like Prozac and Zoloft, Paxil, and Luvox, and these what? Enhance the effects of serotonin because they are reuptake inhibitors. So serotonin will exist in the synaptic cleft for a longer period of time. Right? So they block reuptake of serotonin, prolonging its action. Right? So all of these things are used clinically quite a bit. Right? Dopamine, another kind of neurotransmitter. So in this class, I want you to know various kinds of neurotransmitters and become a little familiar with maybe what some of their actions are. There are two major dopamine systems in the brain, and I don't think I'm going to ask you to know the names of these right here, but this first one right here has to do with the basal ganglia. Actually, it's called the basal nuclei right now, which control motor activity in a person's body. The basal nuclei allow you to move in a nice, very fluid way. All right, when somebody has damage to the basal nuclei, they can't move in a fluid way. So if you want to extend your arm moves in a very jerky fashion. All the motions in your body are very jerky, and you have very poor balance, and you kind of look inebriated, actually, because you have such poor motor control. And so somebody that's in an automobile wreck or something and the basal nuclei become damaged, they might come down with like an artificial case of Parkinson's disease, for instance. Or there's a very famous boxer, unfortunately, got hit in the head just too many times and damaged some of the basal nuclei, okay, and gave him an early onset of Parkinson's disease, and that is Muhammad Ali. And you have to be kind of aware of that if you're ever in a clinical setting, because when you run into a patient with Parkinson's, your first impression is going to be drug seeker, okay, substance abuser, something like that. And somebody with Parkinson's disease, right, is not a substance abuser, right, and you don't want to label them like that. They have this particular condition happening inside their brain, so you got to use a lot more compassion, right, and different modes of treatment and everything else. Oh, who is the actor that has early onset Parkinson's disease? Oh yeah, Michael J. Fox. Maybe I'll say a little bit more about that in just a little bit. So it has to do with that dopamine system. The other system right here, involving the mesolimbic system, is involved with emotional reward and behavior. And this is the system that is activated by most recreational drugs. Opiates in particular, like heroin. And And so most addictions activate this particular system because it involves this emotional reward component right here. Hyperactivity of this particular system causes schizophrenia, right? And anti-dopaminergic drugs is a way to control schizophrenia. So here is the, as you see, kind of the link between opiates, schizophrenia, and these motor disorders right here. So one of the things that we always think about when somebody has an early onset of Parkinson's, like for instance Michael J. Fox, is that they were abusing some kind of heroin or opiates, right? Which then poisons the receptors, and that produces an early onset of Parkinson's disease. But Michael J. Fox said, oh, I never abused drugs when I was a little kid. And, you know, I kind of believe him because he's from Canada, and he kind of talks like I do. All right, so he's a reputable kind of guy. But that doesn't mean that maybe somebody didn't slip him some drugs, and that's actually what people are thinking now because of a number of child actors that were on those sets when he was filming Family Ties had come down with early onset Parkinson's disease. So we think that even without their knowledge, some producer or movie mogul was spiking their drinks with something, the stimulant, to keep them up during the filming of all those different episodes, which is really kind of sad if that happens. No way to prove it one way or the other. All right, the other thing, that I'll try to put a link of this in the Blackboard as well. In England, there were a group of addicts that got a batch of home-cooked-up heroin, and not only did it work with their mesolimbic system, it also bound to receptors in the basal nuclei, all right, and the effects of that binding, because it was such a strange compound, they were never terminated. Those ligands have forever bound to the receptors in the nigrosubstantial dopamine system, and it has completely paralyzed them. Okay, yeah, so it's permanent paralysis. They are completely normal, completely cognitive functions, but they can't control a single function in their body due to inactivation of their skeletal system. So I'll try to, and that's a case, you could do a 60 Minutes did a nice story on that. It's called The Frozen Addicts. If you do a Google, maybe you could find some information on that. So these different systems can produce all kinds of very interesting, right, and catastrophic and sad things in people, but also some very good things if we learn how to manipulate those systems. Norepinephrine is used in the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system. In the peripheral nervous system, it's used as the sympathetic autonomic nervous system neurotransmitter, right? So sympathetic as opposed to what? Parasympathetic. Remember, autonomic nervous system has these two divisions, which is going to be our next chapter, so we're going to be really involved with looking at neurotransmitters in the next chapter. Right, in the central nervous system, it increases the general activity of various neurons, so that's what amphetamines stimulate. They stimulate norepinephrine pathways in the brain. Okay, there are other kinds of neurotransmitters. Some of these are pretty new on the scene. Glutamic acid, aspartic acid, glycine, and even gamma-aminobutyric acid. These are all amino acids, which, again, are what? Building blocks of proteins. These can be used as neurotransmitters in different neurons. Glutamic acid and aspartic acid work in a big time in the central nervous system, and they're always going to be excitatory. All right, so what? And they're going to work through G-protein-coupled receptors. So how are they going to work? They're going to open up what kind of channels if they're excitatory? For instance, a sodium channel, which will then depolarize the cell, bring it closer to threshold, and produce an EPSP. Glycine, on the other hand, and GABA as well, are inhibitory neurotransmitters. Right? And don't forget, antagonism in the nervous system is critically important. You need inhibitory neurotransmitters. And inhibitory neurotransmitters can work in two different ways. They can open up a potassium channel, which will hyperpolarize the cell, or they can open up a chloride channel, right? Chlorine will enter the cell. That will also hyperpolarize the membrane, driving it farther away from threshold, inhibiting the cell. All right, and gamma-aminobutyric acid is the most common neurotransmitter in the brain, and it's an inhibitory neurotransmitter that works on chloride channels. And it's when there's an inappropriate building of those receptors in the brain, these chloride channels right here, that's what produces Huntington's disease, which is a motor deficit. Okay, so let's talk about synaptic integration. And if we look at the neuron over here at, on the right, right, where, what part of the neuron is actually going to integrate signals up? It's going to look at all EPSPs and IPSPs, add them all up together and make a decision on what to do. Yeah, the axon hillock right here. Okay. All right, so let's go back to the slide on the left. And remember, there are two kinds of events on the cell membrane. There can be action potentials and there can be graded potentials. And let's go talk about this neuron, or you could look at the neuron on the right over here. Where do we have action potentials and why? We have action potentials on the axon because you have voltage-gated channels, right? And you have graded potentials on dendrites and cell body because you have ligand-gated channels, right? Ligand-gated channels can't transmit action potentials, but they can institute either an EPSP or an IPSP. And we see a graph right here of membrane potential versus time, and I see some deviations from resting membrane potentials. And notice, what direction are they moving? Toward threshold, right? So these are depolarizing events, and a depolarizing event you're going to call an excitatory or an inhibitory postsynaptic? It's excitatory, right? So you see that deviation up towards zero. These are EPSPs. Now we call this a postsynaptic potential because where is it happening? I see an axon right here, that's one cell, and then I see dendrites and cell body of a second neuron. What do we call this first neuron right here? That's the presynaptic neuron. And this one right here, too bad it's different, not different colors, this right here is the postsynaptic membrane. And where are the graded potentials being generated? In the postsynaptic neuron. So that's why we call these excitatory postsynaptic potentials, because they are occurring in the postsynaptic neuron right here due to binding of ligands to ligand-gated channels or G proteins that can somehow activate other kinds of channels. All right, so graded in magnitude, right, they can go up or down. They have no threshold. If a channel opens up, it's going to change the membrane potentials. And EPSPs always cause depolarization. They can summate. For instance, right, if we have two graded potentials right here, if they're applied at two different locations within the cell, and if they fuse together, they will just add together. And if when they add together, then it might reach threshold by the time that graded potential reaches the axon hillock right here. And they have no refractory period. So a graded potential or an EPSP or IPSP is what? A totally different kind of beast than an action potential because it relies on different membrane proteins in the cell membrane. Okay. So since graded potentials can summate, let's look at this scheme right over here. All right, so 1 and 2, what kind of neurons do we call these? 1 and 2 are? And we're thinking about a synapse. So our focus of attention is a synapse. 1 and 2 are presynaptic cells. They are both going to stimulate this postsynaptic cell. And in this particular example, both 1 and 2, all right, are going to release excitatory neurotransmitter, which means it's going to open up a sodium channel. They're going to produce EPSPs. So in the first case, right, only neuron number 1 is going to transmit an action potential to the postsynaptic cell, and it's going to release some neurotransmitter that produces this amount of EPSP on the postsynaptic membrane. And what could you tell me about this EPSP right here? How would you categorize this EPSP? It's excitatory, but doesn't reach threshold. So it is a sub-threshold excitation, all right, by itself. Let's think of a second case where both presynaptic neurons have set an action potential down to the axon terminus, and they both release excitatory neurotransmitter, so more ligand-gated channels are opening up, and so now you get two EPSPs pretty much at the same time, and when they flow from different locations on dendrites or the cell body to the axon hillock, remember that axon hillock funnels all of that information right here to these voltage-gated channels, now what happened? It's a threshold stimulus, and then this neuron then has made a decision to send an action potential. So in the first case, this neuron blocked the transmission of that information. In the second case, it has allowed it to proceed. So this little neuron right here has made a decision for you. That's pretty interesting that neurons can do that kind of stuff. Okay, that happens in the postsynaptic cell. All right, so that can also happen for temporal summation. If I go back to the previous slide, temporal summation, if you only have one neuron right here, but if it's sending an action potential with sufficient frequency to where it produces two ESPs close enough in time, if the second ESP comes before the first one disappears altogether, right, that can also summate to reach threshold. So if the first neuron is releasing sufficient quantities of neurotransmitter, then you might get two ESPs that reach threshold, and we call that temporal summation in time. Okay, so not only can we have excitation, we can also have inhibition, all right, synaptic inhibition. And there are two categories of synaptic inhibition. We have postsynaptic inhibition and presynaptic inhibition. So postsynaptic means what cell is being inhibited? The postsynaptic cell. With presynaptic inhibition, what cell is being inhibited? The presynaptic cell. But let's take a look and see how that happens. I'm not sure that's really clear without looking at what's going on. Postsynaptic inhibition is going to affect events on the postsynaptic cell membrane. And for instance, we have GABA and glycine. We know those produce iPSPs, maybe by opening chloride channels up, right? And iPSPs can summate with ESPs, what, canceling them out. This slide right here says dampen them out, but it can actually cancel them out. All right. So in this particular case, we have two neurons. One is inhibitory and two is excitatory. Number one sends an action potential down, releases GABA or glycine, right? And that's going to open up a chloride channel that produces an iPSP. And then at some later time, but not too late, the second neuron, action potential reaches the axon terminus right here, releases an excitatory neurotransmitter. And what is that going to produce on the postsynaptic membrane, that excitatory neurotransmitter? It's going to produce an ESP. But now where does that ESP start from? Not RMP, but at this way depressed or this way hyperpolarized membrane. And so this ESP, which otherwise would have been a threshold stimulus, now is what? Sub-threshold. Because this integration center is looking at graded potentials from the first presynaptic cell and the second presynaptic cell, and those signals are what, canceling each other out, and so this neuron makes a decision not to transmit any information to the next neuron down the line. Okay, so this would be postsynaptic inhibition because it is occurring in the postsynaptic cell. All right, let's look at presynaptic inhibition. So here we have a nice picture of a neuron. All right, so what color is the postsynaptic cell? It's kind of yellow, right? And we have some red ones here as well. The red ones are, did I get that right? They're not brown or something. Are they brown, red?
Brown.
Oh, they're brown? Aha, okay, I knew it was close. Okay, so these cells right, these darker cells are what, the presynaptic or postsynaptic? Yeah, these are all the presynaptic cells. Okay, so we see what? 1, 2, 3, 4 presynaptic cells. They're all communicating with this one postsynaptic cell. And so this yellow cell is integrating information up from all of them, right? Down here on the axon hillock. Well, let's classify some of these synapses from anatomy. What kind of synapse do we call this one right here? It's coming from an axon, so it's an axosomatic synapse, because it's synapsing on the cell body. Here is an axodendritic synapse, because it's synapsing on a dendrite. And then there's one other class of synapses from anatomy. All right, you got axosomatic, axodendritic, and where is that? It's in this little circle right here. That is an axonic synapse. All right, this is what we didn't believe existed not too long ago, but now we know that they do exist. Okay. And of course, these all can be either excitatory or inhibitory. So this neuron right here is an inhibitory neuron. It's going to release an inhibitory neurotransmitter, maybe opening up, a chloride channel or a potassium channel on the postsynaptic cell right here. And so we call that what? Postsynaptic inhibition. It's producing iPSPs on dendrites and cell body, because that's where those ligand-gated channels are. All right, here is another inhibitory neuron going to release inhibitory neurotransmitter. But let's drop down to this one right here. Here is an excitatory neuron. It's going to release what kind of neurotransmitter at this axodendrite? These are both kind of look like axodendritic synapses right here. What kind of neurotransmitter? Yeah, excitatory. So it's going to produce ePSPs at these synapses right here. But notice that this inhibitory neuron can modulate the effects of this excitatory neuron, because not only does it have a synapse on a dendrite, it also has a synapse on this inhibitory neuron's axon. And it could produce iPSPs on this excitatory axon, which means then it's going to block the transmission of an action potential across this little place on the axon. And when it's blocked, then that excitatory signal can't get to the postsynaptic cell. And since that inhibition is occurring on which cell? It's the presynaptic cell. We call that presynaptic inhibition, because it's releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter on the presynaptic cell. If there's a neuron that releases inhibitory neurotransmitter on the postsynaptic cell, we call that postsynaptic inhibition. All right, so your nervous system is pretty interesting and complicated. And guess what kind of cell directs the nervous system to develop all these different relationships and connections between them? Okay, and that is an astrocyte. Okay, so astrocytes not only sometimes are involved with reuptake of neurotransmitter, but they can also release neurotrophins that can cause different neurons to grow or proliferate different processes, so they can make different connections with inside the brain. And when you have more connections inside the brain, then that increases the processing power of that brain. And that's why, you know, it's always good to learn a new language every year, or pick up a new instrument every year, or take an anatomy class or physiology class, because your brain is always remodeling and you just get smarter as you use the brain, as you use your own brain. All right, so that's it for some physiology of the brain. So now we got to come to grips as to whether we're going to take the test on Thursday or not. Okay. And I know the last test was delayed, so it got switched from a Tuesday to a Thursday. So in a sense, I wouldn't mind switching it from a Thursday back to a Tuesday, so that the people that have labs on those days, we don't keep hammering them over and over and over again. So we'll have to go on with lecture, okay? So that actually means, I suppose, that we could put the autonomic nervous system on the test, but I won't do that. I'll keep the test the same. So this will be the last chapter on the test, and we can take it on Tuesday. So I'll send an email out to everybody. All right, so that means that you got to work a lot of exercise. There are a lot of good interactive exercises in Blackboard. And I want you guys to have a lot of fun with this information over the weekend. This is really super information for you to know, but you have to work with it. You just can't come to lecture and have it sink in. You really have to work with it one way or the other. Okay. So before I move on, questions. I'm going to move on to autonomic nervous system, because we got about a half hour left in lecture. But I want to talk about... 10 minutes? Okay, well, I'll talk fast. Okay, back in the previous chapter in metabolism, we had the Cori cycle. And I don't have the diagram right with me, but the Cori cycle is a way of cycling lactate, all right, from a skeletal muscle cell back to the into the circulatory system to the liver, and the liver can then take that lactate and make glucose out of it again. Who can figure out what that process is? That the liver taking lactate, making glucose out of it? And that is gluconeogenesis. Yeah, you really got to think of those terms, right? And if you look at those terms in the book and you can't see that they're different words or spelled differently, guess what you have to have? New pair of glasses, right? So you got to make sure you can spell and pronounce those words. All right, so that's gluconeogenesis. That's pretty easy to determine, but there are some enzymes in that pathway. All right, so going from glucose to glycogen, what do we call that? Glucose to glycogen is glycogenesis. All right, the reverse of that process, when your blood glucose starts to depress itself, so the liver is going to take glycogen, convert it back into glucose. That's glycogenolysis. Now, here are a couple enzymes, right, that I went over in lecture, but it's not clearly talked about in the book. Now, when glucose is clipped off of glycogen, it's in a phosphorylated form. It's like glucose 1-phosphate or glucose 6-phosphate. All right, that glucose can't leave a liver cell. There has to be an enzyme that's going to chop off that phosphate group, so that you have a naked glucose that can go through the liver plasma membrane into the blood. Okay, and that is a phosphatase, right? Glucose 6-phosphatase takes a phosphate group off. That's not clearly labeled in your textbook, but you should appreciate that. All right, so just know that a phosphatase removes a phosphate group. When a glucose enters a liver cell, it is phosphorylated immediately so that it can either enter glycolysis or go up to make glycogen. All right, what kind of enzyme takes a naked glucose and turns it into a glucose 6-phosphate? A kinase. Yeah, so you should label those on that diagram as well. All right, I probably didn't have to go over that again, but I had a couple questions, and people said, oh, well, I kind of knew that, but I felt uneasy with my knowledge. You guys got to become just a little bit more sure of yourselves and your knowledge, right? Just rely on those basic principles. Something that takes a phosphate off is a phosphatase. Something that runs around phosphorylating things is a kinase. Yeah. And it's used all over the place in cells. Okay. So I did want to go back and talk about that. Are there any other questions about the previous chapters? Yeah. Well, you focus on, it's not a bad thing, because when we get into the autonomic nervous system, we're going to revisit, and in a much bigger way, these various kinds of neurotransmitters and receptors. But always focus on the exam study guide to answer that kind of question. So if there are questions, like check your understanding that I have listed that you should know about within the chapter before you get to the end, right? They have questions within the chapter. Check your understanding questions. Make sure you can answer those. Questions at the end of the chapter that I've put on the exam study guide, or any questions on the online questions, then those are, you know, really things that you should know. And if you know the answers to those questions, then of course you should be able to answer those questions on the test, or even put a couple of those questions together to interpolate to get to an answer that I put on the test. So focus on the exam study guide. Oh, the quantitative questions? Yeah, but I got to remember to do that. So I wouldn't have my feelings hurt if somebody sends me an email. But probably not everybody has to send me an email.
Okay.
It's not activated?
No,
there's no answer key? Okay, send me an email and I'll check and see what happened. I know Blackboard was a little funky this week because they upgraded, and I'm kind of pleased with some of the problems that they took out of it. So it's working a lot better for me. Hopefully it will work a lot better for you guys. Let's go over this neuron. Okay, I don't want you guys are looking a little restless. I don't want you to run out. But I want to take another question, okay? But so just hang tight. Yeah. Yeah, I sure will. I'll post up 3 lectures. I got 2 from last week and then the 1-4 today. Yeah. Oh, rats. Rats. Here it is. Right here. Sign it really fast and pass it around. Thank you. That's really important. Yeah. It is an exam figure. This is, yeah, it's in the exam study guide. And so I gave you a practice diagram with just question marks. And since that one is not in your book, I also give you this one as a key. So let's talk about this one a little bit. Let's see if we can really understand what's going on right here. So we got what? Just a typical multipolar neuron. So don't forget, you got to know neurons by their shape, and with their shape, it has different functions, right? Some are sensory, some are motor, some are integration, association neurons. Two main areas of a neuron, you got dendrites and cell body versus axons, different kinds of different kinds of proteins in the membrane. Dendrites and cell body has what? Ligand-gated channels. That makes that the receiving end of the neuron. In the axon, you have voltage-gated channels. That makes it the sending end of a neuron because it can transmit action potentials because of those voltage-gated channels. All right, there are different kinds of potentials or graded potentials that can be produced by ligand-gated channels. They can be EPSPs or IPSPs. Always, a nicotinic is always going to be an EPSP. And, for instance, a muscarinic, and these are referring to acetylcholine, so these are cholinergic receptors. Right, muscarinic can either be an produce IPSPs or EPSPs depending on what kind of ion channels are activated. Right, if you have a muscarinic receptor that opens up a potassium channel, what kind of postsynaptic potential will it make? An IPSP, but if it opens up a sodium channel, it's going to make an EPSP. Right, so graded potentials flow over dendrites and cell bodies, and how do they propagate themselves? Okay, we say with decrement, right? They fade away. So if you excite the very tip of a dendrite, it might fade away by the time it gets to this axon hillock right here. But the interesting thing about graded potentials is that if you have a number coming from a number of different locations, they can summate, right? Graded potentials can summate. All right, if we look on this axon right here, right in this region, there's a transition from ligand-gated channels to voltage-gated channels, and remember, voltage-gated channels have a threshold, so it can make a decision whether it will start an action potential or not. And so the axon hillock is an area for integration, adding a whole bunch of signals up together. The other thing that we see right here are some neuroglia cells that we call, these would be Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system, oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system, and you only have voltage-gated channels in the nodes of RONVA right here. And underneath the myelin sheaths, you don't have any voltage-gated channels, so that potential travels kind of like a graded potential in this region right here. Right? And it kind of dies away, but it still reaches threshold by the time it reaches this node of RONVA, so another action potential starts right here, and then it hops to over here, and it hops to over here. The reason why graded potential never dies away underneath this myelin sheath is because it acts as insulation and doesn't allow that voltage to leak out of the cell. Unlike a dendrite and cell body, right, there's a lot of electricity that can leak out of dendrites and cell body, and it is conducted with a lot of decrement through dendrites and cell body, but not underneath the myelin sheath right here. So it hops. So saltatory conduction is what kind of conduction? It is fast or slow? That's fast, right? And continuous conduction is slow. It is non-myelinated. So I think this is a pretty handy figure for you to figure out. I don't know if before today it made a lot of sense, but after today's lecture, it should make a lot of sense to you. If it doesn't, I got to see you on Thursday during office hours or something. All right, the other thing is that everybody now, there's one group of lab that still has to take the action potential quiz at the end of lab. So don't complete lab and run out because you'll be gypped out of points if you do that. All right, so don't leave lab until your instructor says it's okay to go. All right, anybody have any other questions on these axoaxonic, axodendritic, axosomatic? Yes, here's a question.
I just have a question.
Okay.
Okay, a muscarinic
potassium channel.
Was that IPSP?
Always produces IPSPs because when a potassium opens up, potassium leaves the cell. What's the charge of potassium?
Positive.
When a positive charge leaves the cell, what happens to the voltage inside the cell? Becomes more negative, moves farther away from threshold, means it's harder to excite with an EPSP. So a muscarinic mechanism that opens up a potassium channel is inhibitory, produces IPSPs. All right, and the other cool thing that your book doesn't make a big deal about is a cascade mechanism. What are some characteristics of a cascade mechanism? Multiple levels of amplification, and it's fast because that happens. And that's because enzymes aren't degraded when they catalyze the reaction. Okay? So that's something else that's important. Okay, so that's it for class today. So test a week from today. Oh yeah, and the sign-in sheet. Keep that sign-in sheet going around. Where's the sign-in sheet at? Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
The sheaths of Schwann surround axons in the peripheral nervous system. True. But not in the central nervous system. That's true.
But then it's still wrong.
I don't know who wrote the answers to some of those questions. What's in the central nervous system? I think I don't object to that question because you should know that, like you noticed.
There's
that would be an oligodendrocyte in the CNS.
There's some answer to that question. Can I ask you what is this from lactic?
Okay, let's look. Let's
look. Okay. Lactic to lactic.
I better turn my recorder off before I...